Welcome to the Alcohol Free Life podcast, brought to you by thesoberclub.com. I'm Genuinely Grace. This is for you if you've quit the booze or you'd like to, or maybe you're just sober curious. I'll bring you tips and motivation without any judgment, and there'll be inspiration from experts, quitlet authors, and sober heroes. Hi, and welcome to the Alcohol Free Life podcast from the Sober Club. It was fantastic to meet some of you a few nights ago at Club Soda for our 250th episode, which is in fact actually in 2 weeks. So that's when you'll get to hear that episode. I mean, I've got to do it right. Okay. It was close enough. It was just the most fantastic evening. I'm so grateful to those of you who were able to come. And if you were not able to come that night, you know, don't get too much FOMO. Number one, we will do something similar again. I'll tell you a bit more about that later. And number two, you were still very much in our thoughts. It really was like a celebration of connection, really, in that room. It was just amazing to sense the high vibe energy. I tell you what, when sober people get together, it's fantastic fun. What on earth is that ridiculous, you know, phrase, sober people are boring, or sober, anagram of bores? I mean, the opposite is true. We had such fun. It was really such a nice, incredible, fun evening. And I was very grateful to my guests, William Porter, Claire Pooley, Laura Willoughby, a whole host of Sober Club members were able to come, and a whole bunch of coaches I've trained as well. So that was really fun. And then lots of podcast listeners who are not members of the club, but just fantastic to connect with some of you for the first time. It really was a great vibe. It really was. So anyways, we will do it something similar. Obviously, I'm not going to wait for another 250 episodes. We thought we would do something similar in October, because I've got another one of my coaches and Sober Club members, Paul, is coming over from the US, and we've started a bit of a trend now, right? Because the last evening, Tuesday the 15th, was planned because one of our Sober Club members, Cindy, was coming over from Australia. And, you know, she'd said, oh, it'd be great to get together. So and then she brought along another member who is also from the US. So, you know, they've set the bar pretty high. When I get messages from people saying, oh, you know, it's a shame it's in London because I live in, you know, Norfolk, or I live in Yorkshire. It's such a shame it's in London. I mean, seriously, guys, she set the bar high now. She can make it from Australia. So we will probably do another one anyways in October, probably be I'm looking at Wednesday, the 11th of October. So put that date in your diary. The tickets will sell out fast, and I will, of course, jack up some amazing special guests. So just a huge thanks to everyone who was there, and thanks to everyone who cheered us on, even though you weren't in the room. Your presence was felt. It really was. It did really feel as though it was a celebration of the amazing connection that the Sober Club and that this podcast really feels as though it kind of brings together and holds people in that space. So it really was magical. So thank you again. It was just amazing. And I do feel very blessed as well that my guest this week, I mean, this took me right back to my kind of music biz days, getting to interview Jim Sony Sunnyfield from Hootie and the Blowfish. What a treat. He actually found me because his book is out, and he actually found me. So it seems my podcast is, I don't know, Googleable, must be. I know it does pop up in the top 20 of the Apple mental health chart pretty much every week. So that's really cool. But yeah, the fact that it reached Sony in the States is really good news. So I'll bring you that interview. Must just remind you of a few key dates. So I've already mentioned that possible dates, not confirmed yet, in October, but that will probably be that second week of October. Also around that time, October the 15th, Sunday, October the 15th, is very likely to be our next Family Constellations Day. So many of you have heard me talk about family constellations, way too big a topic to try to explain in a couple of sentences. But, you know, have a look at some of the stuff that I've written on the Sober Club. If you go to thesoberclub.com, you'll find some stuff about constellations. And it really is one of those things that you just have to be open and come and experience it, because it's absolutely magical. So that will be in Hertfordshire, Sunday, October the 15th. So pop that date in the diary, drop me a message if you know that you're interested before I get the tickets on sale. If you are a coach, a therapist or a coach, then I'm going to be doing a coach's mastermind day and a day around attracting the perfect clients for your heart-centered business. That will be on Saturday the 14th of October. And then before all of that, there's likely to be another Sober by the Sea. So if you fancy creating a vision board, it doesn't matter what stage you're at, we call it Sober by the Sea. But if you're just sober curious, it's absolutely fine, because it's really just about looking at what it is you want for your future. So that date is likely to be the 8th of October. So we'll pop that those details in place as well. So there's going to be a lot happening in October. Ahead of that, we'll probably do an online constellations in September. So that'll be exciting as well. What else do I need to tell you? Our Champneys date has changed. So apologies to anyone who has already booked it. Obviously, you'll be refunded if you can't make the new date, but the new date is going to be November 4th to the 5th. So there's a lot of admin stuff there. Sorry about that. But I tell you what, this interview is worth the wait, particularly if you're a bit of an old muso. You're going to really enjoy this one. Well, I'm absolutely delighted. This feels like I'm going back to my music biz days, honestly. Since forever, I have loved Hootie and the Blowfish, and I'm so delighted that I get to chat to, we're going to call him Sony, Jim Sonnefeld. Have I got that right, or have I blown it already?
Nailed it.
Okay, well, we'll call you Sony. I understand that that's okay. Just such a fascinating story. I haven't had a chance to read the whole book yet, but original drummer, of course, of Hootie and the Blowfish, and now this author of this book, Swimming with the Blowfish, which is your memoir. And what we're going to talk about, of course, is hopefully a bit about your background and your sobriety and just how it's impacted on everything. So it's amazing to connect with you, Sony. It really is. I feel like we ought to have met in the past, but I don't know whether Hootie and the Blowfish ever came into Radio 2. Would you remember that?
We dabbled in UK radio. We toured in like from 95 to 2000 and then went back for a brief visit in 2019. Didn't do a ton of media in 2019, but had a blast going back to the same venues.
I think you might have come into Virgin Radio when I was working there. Or at least we might have come to a gig. So we've kind of connected, but obviously in a very different path. just take me back then. Let's just talk a bit about those Hootie and the Blowfish days. Tell us, share with us some of your memories, I guess. I mean, we think of, wasn't it the Letterman show that really kicked off that album, the Crack Rear View? Wasn't it Letterman?
I always love the saying, luck is when preparation meets opportunity.
And it was I love that.
On a high school gymnasium growing up, and I never quite understood it until we'd been working as a band for probably 5 years, paying our dues, toiling in the clubs, learning our songwriting craft, and got signed to Atlantic. And still, it wasn't a guarantee. But when luck happened, our preparation and the opportunity of David Letterman hearing our first song that was a little bit on the radio at the time in 1994, he heard Hold My Hand. And that's where, the synergy really kicked off. We were an unknown band. We'd worked our butt off. We had a good following on the southeast of America and the East Coast, but no real break until Letterman says, get me these guys with the funny band name and have them play this little 3.5 minute song. And we did. And that changed our trajectory. As you know, it can take one moment or the right person seeing you or something in the air. And that was our moment.
And aren't I right in thinking that he said something like, if you don't have this album, there's something wrong with you.
We did. I mean,
and then everyone went out and bought it.
For no apparent reason, became our biggest fan fast. You know, he said things like that. You're crazy if you don't have it. Or recognizes in a very personal way, even though we weren't friends. Is Hootie ready? He would say when we're about to come on. And like, it was so endearing. And it was a fabulous moment. And that really created a lot of energy. Radio started playing the song once his audience of 6 million people hear it on TV. Suddenly it's a lot easier to get played on the radio.
Yeah, of course.
And we moved from playing, you know, clubs in 94 to amphitheaters by the end of the year. And we're headlining an amphitheater tour, 20,000 people a night in the summer of 95. So the long journey of paying dues is an overnight success, thanks to David Letterman.
Yeah, absolutely. And where does the name come from? I'm sure you've answered that question a million times, but I don't think I know.
We had some college friends, and Darius, our singer, was always given nicknames, not always complimentary either, but he had nicknamed one guy the Blowfish for his big jowls, and another guy was Hootie. Either big glasses or big eyes, like an owl. And they walked into a party one night, and somebody said, "Hey, Hootie and the Blowfish are here." And ding, someone else said, "Well, that'd be a good band name." And if I was there, I would have said, "That'd be a terrible band name." But hey, I was not a voting member.
Right. Cool. So tell us a little bit about the days on the road then. I mean, I'm guessing that's when the drinking ramped up. I mean, it's what we know of rock and roll, isn't it? With endless touring and all the rest of it. I guess that was where it all ramped up for you.
Yeah, it was sure a nice place to camouflage what was probably already a healthy drinking appetite. And when you have the sort of people out there in the world really accepting you and lifting you up and putting you on this pedestal, any of your typical flaws that you already may be aware of or unaware of suddenly wash to the side. You can do no wrong in a lot of people's eyes. They see you as, oh, he's famous. He's making it. He's good. He looks on the outside like a safe person and a safe man having a good time. But, you know, for me, I'd been experimenting. I think at age 14 was when I first got in front of peers who were using drugs and alcohol. And though I knew better from the parents and the priests and the police that had visited our home, I still went right for it. I had this attitude of, I want a thrill. I want to see what it does to me. And when I put it in me immediately, I liked what it did. So I rode a little roller coaster from age 14 to 15 years before we made it, when that Letterman moment happened. And you spend a lot of times in clubs. You spend a lot of times practicing nightly geographic changes. So if I would have a bad night in Raleigh, North Carolina, I'd always put it behind me because we're headed to Wilmington, North Carolina the next night, or Washington, D.C., or New York. And I always escaped a lot of trauma, I think, as a result of that continued movement. And when we hit the big time, it just meant it made me feel like we'd succeeded. And alcohol, if nothing else in our society, is a celebration of achievement or a moment on the calendar. And this was the biggest moment that we four had ever dreamed of. So it lasted more than a few nights, probably 5 years of riding the top. You know, you've been there, you have hits and radios playing the new stuff, and the new album is a hit with everyone. But eventually by around 2001, you know, it's obvious we're coming down, and the next band with cooler hair and tighter jeans are taking our place. And I didn't know quite what to do with that. I'd started a family, and since alcohol always meant celebration and success, when we were coming down and I felt it on the inside, and it created fear and doubt, I kept raising the glass higher and faster and more often to say, no, this is all good. We're celebrating. Yeah. It's okay. And it wasn't okay because I got caught in that cycle that I couldn't turn off, and eventually led to drugs and bad behavior. Not in that order necessarily, but by 2004, the end of it, it was a train wreck. I had a wheel or two on the tracks.
And
got kicked out of the band. Hadn't lost my family yet, but it was apparent that I was fighting something that was bigger and stronger than me.
Yeah, absolutely. Just to go back to those days on the road for a moment, you know, I remember that, I mean, people always talk about how there's all the you know, there's so much alcohol in this profession and the music biz. And there is, I mean, they're right. I mean, I happen to think that there's alcohol in pretty much every profession. You know, you go meet a doctor in the UK or a teacher and they'll tell you the same thing. But I think one of the differences is that in the music biz, it's all free, right? You never have to put your hand in your pocket. You know, every gig you do has got a rider, and the only thing that changes as you get more famous is there's more expensive booze on the, you know, there for you and more of it. So it's just the constant supply, which can't be helpful, really. I mean, were the other guys in the band on the same kind of path or not?
No, I mean, everybody had an ability to say when, except for me. And as we got further into sort of fame and world travel, and then coming home and trying to, you know, get a normal head on your shoulders, they noticed, and I didn't seem to care. I didn't think it was a big deal that when we went home, I was still using, you know. I liked the joy and the celebration of, you know, coming home and your family and celebrating with friends. And my wife at the time liked to socialize. So I never turned it off. And it took some time for them to realize he goes home and parties and drinks every night. And I was like, yeah. And what I didn't know at the time either is that as my tolerance went up and my chase for that good feeling got more diligent, you know, I was afraid to ever turn it off.
Yeah.
I would get like these flu symptoms and not feel right. I would always get sick if I was convinced that I needed to stop for a few days. And I didn't know till much later that was called detoxing. It was dangerous and medical. And it meant that I was in trouble.
Yeah. Wow. So what was the kind of turning point for you then? I read that one of your children actually found you in an uncompromising position, which was not helpful.
Yeah, I had two little kids at the time, and I'd been intervened, you know, to be sure, by my friends and my bandmates and family members were trying to encourage me in that. You know, if you've ever had an intervention, it's not great when your friends gather around to say they love you and they're worried about you, but they're going to try and get you to stop doing something. I'd been through that already, but it wasn't until my 4-year-old daughter, Cameron, sort of found me. I'd built a detached place to record and have my own time away from our house. Mm. And I also conveniently had a full bar back there and a place to stash things. And I'd often, you know, just not make it out of there. I'd stay late and then I wouldn't make it back in the house. And she came out on a Sunday morning, basically with a very pure 4-year-old question. And she hopped on my chest. I was passed out. It was 10:30 in the morning. And I had the same clothes on that I'd read to her the night before. I probably stunk. And she just said, "Dad, what are you doing?" And it was a very simple question with a very pure, you know, sort of place in her heart. She meant, "Why aren't you inside with the family? Why aren't you with us?" And she repeated it. "What are you doing? Dad, what are you doing?" And she finally ran off frustrated, and I was stuck there with sort of, you know, looking upwards going, what am I doing here? Let's get honest for the first time ever.
Yeah.
Am I under control of some chemicals, or am I running the show? Is there something bigger than me even out there in the stratosphere that might be able to help me with this? And, that was the moment. It was like I call it a God knock, but for anybody that isn't into that idea, something happened to me on that day that I had never had that thought before. I was always like, "I'm not quitting," or "Don't tell me what to do." And at this moment, I had an idea that just dropped in from somewhere, and it said, "You probably need to ask somebody for help because you don't seem to be controlling it." And I did. I walked out of that room, past my Hootie and the Blowfish gold plaques and accolades on the wall. It was quite ironic that I'm staring at these things and they hold no power at that moment. I know I'm defeated. I'm the boxer in the ring on the mat, and I've got to ask someone for help. And I'm a 40-year-old successful male, and that is harder than maybe anybody, because I think I'm running the show, right? Me and my ego anyway. And so I did. I reached out to a guy that I knew who had changed his life. I didn't know exactly what he was doing, but he invited me to come to a group of these people that were meeting regularly, and they were practicing this 12-step model. And I had no reason not to try it, because I was in quite a lot of desperation. I guess that's what got me walking down those stairs. Ultimately, I was desperate to get away from the pain and the confusion that sort of life, you know, leads to.
Yeah, amazing. I mean, it really is that kind of when that light bulb goes on, isn't it? And you're finally able to admit, okay, I haven't got this.
Right,
And
it's miserable, but
yeah.
it can be it's the beginning of something, just when you think
Exactly.
it's the end of something.
Yeah, totally. And am I right in thinking that you also did find faith as a or was that much later?
Yeah, no, I kind of started off somebody, I enjoyed the power of transparency. I was seeing and witnessing in these 12-step groups. It blew me away because I'd been in some church settings where I didn't ever feel like it was either on the up and up or that I could be fully honest without some retribution. Mm. And these groups were doing it very different. They were telling their stories of their difficulties that involved, losing spouses or jobs or vehicles or licenses or and others that had lost their lives. And they were quite open and honest. And they also were sort of selling this solution that they said they had. And I thought, this is like an incredible place of healing. And I saw it from the first meeting I went to. So when they said, keep coming back, no pressure, I came right back. I was intrigued. And so a friend had given me what they call a recovery Bible, and it sort of sewed together for me some of the, I guess, Roman Catholic Bible principles that I'd pushed aside from a young age. And it sewed them back in with some of the 12-step principles, and allowed me to come up and accept, maybe there is something happening with this Bible, the principles at least, mm-hmm. maybe not all of the theology, which I still don't understand sometimes, but I got a good mixture of both. And that was all I needed to go forward. I needed to know that, I wasn't God necessarily. I needed to have help and a group around me and maybe a few confidential people that I could really trust on a deep level.
Yeah. And I read, or I think I heard on you say in an interview, that you found the Serenity Prayer particularly helpful. Tell us about that.
I needed something pragmatic, as much the spiritual always meant to me in my childhood and trying to understand these bigger theologies. It always meant something mystical and sort of flaky at times. And I wasn't ever sure of that. And when someone showed me the 12-step model, it seemed rather pragmatic. And some of the prayers associated with it also seemed kind of more logical and like, let's talk about the bottom line here. And so for me, the Serenity Prayer is where I can, after I've discovered myself and I understand sort of what makes me tick and my flaws, I can say on a daily basis to try and give it over to some power, I can say, hey, grant me the serenity to accept things I can't change and courage to change the things I can. There's really everything I have in my life fits in one of those two categories. And then it says, and let me organize those and see the difference, because sober or drunk, it doesn't matter. I can get in trouble fighting fights that are not mine. I can blame people for things that are my problem. And I need to have that organized on a daily basis, or I'm not going to get serenity. And I've loved that prayer is a place I can always get to remind myself, okay, am I fighting the right fight here?
Yeah.
Or do I need to give in and let life happen because I can't control it? It just always gives me one of two lanes to go in.
Sure. Now, I guess if I were to ask you, some of the benefits that you've found since you got sober, I mean, we'd be here for hours, wouldn't we, really, if we listed them all.
Right.
But just share a few, particularly in relation to, your life. I mean, I'm guessing number one, you became a much better parent, right? Because it's the best parenting hack ever, isn't it? Best gift we can ever give to our kids. But what about for you as a musician, for you as, because, sorry, I'm slightly switching questions here, but, we sometimes hear, don't we, that musicians can sometimes say, oh, wow, I might not be creative if I'm not getting high. I've heard people say that. So how did it impact your life, I'm guessing, for the better?
Yeah, that's great. I had real fears, and a lot of people that are in that middle place of...
Did you? Did you really?
Oh, my God. It kept me...
What if I can't write a song if I'm not high? Is it that?
Yeah. I had years, and it's what kept me drinking, the fear. I was drinking at the fear of, I can't do this in front of 10,000 people without the thing that I've been doing regularly.
Yeah,
I can't.
Yeah.
I've written great songs, and often it's with the elixir of alcohol or drugs. And whether I created it or the drugs helped open my mind, it doesn't matter. It was just the fear that I would have to change trying to do my creative process in a completely different way. And that scared the hell out of me. And it scares a lot of people and probably keeps them in the booze for fear of that. When I finally made that cutoff and said, it's obvious, it's controlling me, I've got to try a new way, I found the greatest gift was time. I had more damn free time where I wasn't obsessing over where to get the first drink or where I wasn't calling out my drug dealer to set up something and have to lie and keep a secret as a result. And then once I started using, I didn't get to control the ending. I don't. Once I start, it starts a craving that I personally can't control. And so I lost all this time thinking I was chasing creativity. And in reality, when I got clean, I had all this damn time and it was, I had the morning. I had never figured out that the morning was something to
Who knew there were 2 6 o'clocks in one day?
The only 6 o'clock I ever saw in the morning was when I was closing the curtains to keep the, you know, people who were going to work out of my conscious. So I had mornings, and, you know, that same daughter who was 4, who gave me my last sort of words of wisdom, what are you doing, Dad? I got to take her, you know, to kindergarten on the first day. And in the book, I write about the thrill that I never thought was a thrill.
Yeah. But
the gratitude that I had for not having that monkey on my back and being able to walk in that school with her, clear-headed as I could be, and say, there is something new for me. And it continued to open the ideas of, I have more time. I have more thinking power. I was getting a little wet brained at the end from my nightly use. And now I felt like some brain cells might've been growing back, and I could start healing some relationships. That was a big part of it too. I had some no boundaries, and I had bad relationships all over the place, and it allowed me to start sorting through that. And I needed a confidant. I needed therapy. I needed the step work. I needed it all. It didn't just come as an event. It was a process that has taken years. And so I have to be diligent, but I love that we get the gift of time, right? Mm. We don't have to go through the things that we put ourselves through.
Yeah, totally. So how many years have you been sober now?
I'm working on 18 plus.
Oh, wow. Wow. Amazing. Yeah. I say this all the time on the podcast, but I just love the fact that people have been sober for so many years. It's still such a thing. It's a thing. And it will always be. It's like, it's because when I got to 1 year, I remember thinking, oh, right, is that kind of it now? Will everything be a bit flat now? But absolutely not. It literally gets better every single year. And I love the fact that people have been sober for years and years and years, just still talk about it. It's more important than their birthday. You know, their soberversary is more important. It's just so massive. It's just such a massive thing, isn't it? It's just beautiful.
If it didn't give us gifts, I don't think we would keep doing it. Honestly,
no, exactly.
Like, it proves that when you do the work and when you put in the work to healing and to, you know, being honest with yourself and open-minded enough to understand other concepts other than your own thoughts, when you have growth in that area, I'm not surprised really that it keeps getting better. That onion we peel back layers to understand deeper themes of our hearts and minds. And yeah, if it didn't get better, I'd probably go back to drinking, honestly.
It does. And it's in so many different ways. And this is where I think it's really difficult to try to explain to other people, because, you know, you talk about the obvious benefits that you hope people are going to feel, but it's tiny things as well. And the fact that being sober helps you feel more brave, and it makes you able to cope with things that you couldn't cope with before, because life doesn't always necessarily become perfect, right? When you stop drinking, you might still get a bit of shit thrown at you, but you're able to deal with it in a different way, just more resilient, more clarity, more calm. Just you can just handle things differently. I think that's been one of the most massive things for me that I could never have expected. I don't think anyone could have described it to me. I wouldn't have really known what it meant, that, and that sense of being able to experience joy. You know, the word joy, I sometimes talk about this, I'd only ever heard the word joy within church circles. Wow. Right. You know, the kind of, you know, you'd sing about joy in a hymn or I only knew the word joy with regard to church. That's it. Or maybe if I, you know, might play with the kids or something, but even then, not really, you know, I really did not know what that meant at all. Mm-hmm. I had no concept of what that felt like.
And how beautiful is the discovery of a new word as an adult to say,
I know.
Freedom is my word that I thought I knew what freedom was. I had this definition and it meant I can do what I want, when I want, I can drink when I want. Yeah. I can tell you to F off. That's freedom to me. And then I discover years down the road, that's not freedom. I have
a freedom
and understanding that is, it surpasses that by miles. It's insane.
Yeah. Totally.
I love that. We get new things again, and we get to see things. Because what I learned more so is that though I wanted to change some people and I wanted to change some things out there that I was hung up on, tangled up in the government this or my lawyer this, I was mad at all these people. The truth was going through either steps or some reconciliation and healing allows me to realize I'm not changing any of them. Let's get that down for sure. I thought I was going to change all these things around me. And the only thing I can change is my own attitude and actions. Yeah. And when I do that, none of the other stuff matters. Mm. There's still a liquor store on the corner. People still are down having a happy hour in the circle. I don't change those things. But, you know, if I try and change myself, you know, with pragmatic either steps or therapy, then I'm winning. I can be in any world and I'll be happy, joyful.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And how was it for you with your, you know, your friends, your colleagues, you know, initially, perhaps, you know, in the early months, because, you know, you hear people say that can be their biggest fear is how, you know, are others going to accept them? Or are they going to be the sober shamers? Will they ever fit in to anything again socially? You know, what was that like for you?
I was kind of proud to say I'm not drinking, or that because I felt like I had so many people to explain that to who I'd hurt or saw me using for so many days in a row and years in a row. So I felt proud to say, hey, I'm not drinking anymore. But I didn't realize, and this took a few years to see that, you know, I had to move into some new friend groups and people groups. There was people that didn't want to hang out with me, and they were friends. They were people I'd known for decades, and I couldn't understand it. It hurt me a little bit for a while, but I think to some degree, I had to remember when I was drinking and when I was using, I didn't want to hang around a sober person. I didn't want to go be with church people who didn't drink, or if they didn't, or I didn't want to be with people that weren't doing what I was doing. And so here I was, the sober guy, all happy to be clean, but I couldn't understand why some of my old friends weren't calling up and we couldn't hang out because I didn't want to go to the pub. I didn't want to go out, and they didn't want to go watch or hang out in the middle of a day with no drinks. And so I lost some, but it's okay, because I think there was healing and gain, and I found a new community around me.
Yeah, I think the connections you make when you're sober are very meaningful. You know, we tend to meet. There are amazing connections. So tell us about the stuff you're doing now then. So, well, first, tell us about the book, first of all. What do we get from the book? How did you write the book? Did you kind of always keep diaries and stuff, or did you just go back in your memory?
I had not really been a formal diary keeper. But when we went off to do our first album, Cracked Review, in Los Angeles, I thought, as I'm walking out the door, I should probably notate some of this. You know, this is before the internet or any of that stuff. And I thought we could go to LA and it could be our last album. It could flop. We could break up. Anything could happen. I'm going to write down what we do there. So I have a journal that I went back from, you know, March of 94 when we were out there in March and April. And it has something that we did every day. I've got ticket stubs, concerts or ball games we attended, all the stuff we did in the studio. And years later, probably 20 years after that album came out, I opened that up and realized what a gift that was to remembering exactly what happened there, because there were no press covering four guys called Hootie and the Blowfish in 1994. We were a baby band. We didn't have a photographer in the studio. There were no video people following us around to interview us. We were just an experimental band on Atlantic Records. And what we did there was only between the four of us, our producer and the engineer and the A&R guy. And this log, this diary I had, was the only real artifact of that. And that was what inspired me to start maybe writing about the band's journey. But really, I wanted to write about the recovery journey, because I feel like people that are on the edge of maybe being fearful of taking a step needed to hear how I did it against some odds. And so I wrote a book that sort of went through how I found Hootie and the Blowfish, the miracle that happened when Letterman invited us, and then what happens when life is disappointing or unfair, or you get dropped from your label, what really happens, and how I used alcohol to try and deal with that, the emotions I couldn't control and didn't understand. The great thing is the book, because of the timing of it, I'd had a bunch of sobriety behind me. I had a rather twisted, fun tale of divorce and sort of rebirth and remarriage that you'll have to read the book to discover. But I ended up married to a person that is everyone in the band knew, and maybe one person in the band was actually married to. So we start again, Laura and I, and we have stepkids, and a big Hootie family becomes even more twisted than ever. And so the timing was great. And I finished it sort of right before COVID. So it gets sort of a happy ending where we've reunited, had a brilliant 50 show tour of 20,000 seat arenas. And it's, and Laura and I are well down the road of our marriage, and our kids are going off to college. It's the timing was quite serendipitous, I'll say. I didn't have to have a COVID story. I didn't have to have any of that. Anyway, I've been bringing out the last year. We spent going out. I play music because I'm one of the songwriters in the band and the background singers. And I'll play music that is affiliated with the Hootie story that the fans know. I tell stories from the book. I do bookstores, fundraisers. There's all sorts of lanes. I'm a corporate speaker as well. So
are you doing anything on the Christian music scene as well?
Yeah, I started writing some more Christian themed music to try and point people to the celebration of rebirth, you know, sobriety for me, probably in 2012, put out three EPs called Found in Love, and then put out another EP last year. I've got a new project about to release as well. That's a re-release, but I've invited some new guests to sing some new versions of the song. So it's an exciting time for me because, you know, as creatives, we want to have something in front of us, right? We're only as good as our next creative dream, I think. And so to have something like this on the plate is a nice thing for me to energize towards as we move to the end of the year.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, it sounds great. I can't wait to finish the book. Swimming with the Blowfish sounds fantastic. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat to me. And I know you've been listening to some of my podcasts. That's very nice.
I'm loving it. I have got to hear some wonderful speakers. I try to get to England. I'm a big football fan, in soccer. And so I've been over numerous times chasing games over there. And so I love, and we have the book released over there in the UK on Omnibus Press. So I'll send you the link and you can post that maybe. But no, I just enjoy conversing about the celebration of not drinking anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much, Sony. I absolutely love it. Great story, and the book sounds fantastic. Thank you so much. And if you come over to London, let me know. Let's meet up. We should do something together. Do an event or something. That'd be great.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'll call when we get there. And cool. Call me if you need me again.
Brilliant. Thanks ever so much. Really appreciate it.
Take care.
So I'll pop the details for the book in the show notes, and really hope you enjoyed that interview. Make sure you share it. It's great if you ever want to write a review of the podcast. Of course, it's so appreciated. You can just go on any podcast platform that you listen on, you know, if it's Spotify or Apple Podcasts or whatever, and write a review. It makes a massive difference. And or of course, you can always drop me a message as well. If you would like to support this work, it would be I'd be so grateful. You can just go to buymeacoffee.com/genuinelygrace. I think that's how you do it. Or you can go to the Sober Club Give Back Fund, where we have a kind of a charitable side to what we do at the Sober Club. Or, of course, you could join us in the Sober Club as a member. You know, that event we had, you know, last week, as I mentioned, I was just so grateful to meet so many Sober Club members. And it just really reminded me of just how important this community is, you know, for all of us. And actually, someone who's a podcast listener, but not a member of the Sober Club, said to me, "Oh, my goodness, I've heard you talk about the Sober Club, but I figured because I've been sober for a little while now, I didn't need to join. It wasn't really for me. But I've just been chatting to a whole bunch of your members. And it's just amazing. They're such great friends and they support each other. And there's so much connection there. And you do so much around optimum well-being in the club, you know." And that's exactly it. It really is not just about not drinking. Of course, that underpins everything. But it really is the everything else. And that incredible power of connection. So do check it out if you've been thinking of joining us. You can always leave if you don't like it, right? Very low cost, very high value. Of course, I would say that, wouldn't I? But it is. So check it out, thesoberclub.com. And whatever stage you're at, whatever you're going through right now, don't struggle on your own. You know, I do still get messages sometimes from people who say, you know, it's they don't necessarily say these words, but it's words to the effect of, I've listened to podcasts, or I've read some of the stuff you've put on social media, and you know, I this is something I really want for myself, but it just doesn't feel possible for me. It feels as though it's possible for everyone else. You got to trust me. This is how I felt. I really felt like that at the beginning. But you know what? It is possible for you. It really, really is. But there's a little bit of work has to be done. You absolutely have to change your mindset. You absolutely have to make this non-negotiable. You have to tell someone. You have to make that commitment and get through the hard bit. Anything worth doing is worth putting a little bit of effort in. And it gets so much easier when you get connection, when you get support on the journey, when you're not just holed up with you and the voice in your head, because that's where it always starts to go wrong. Somebody put a lovely post on our group the other day saying, you know, the voice in my head was so strong. It was literally telling me that I forget what event that she was going to, but she was going to some event, and a fabulous reward at the end of that event would be to sit in the sunshine and have a bottle of fizz because I really deserved it. And she described in detail this chatter, this conversation with the wine witch, you know, and it's so familiar to so many of us, this chat that goes on in your head. And unless you've got someone to bounce that against, you just go and do what you've always done, because that chatter is so strong. And those neural pathways, we've got to change them. We've got to literally furrow, as it were, a new path. Is that the right expression? You know what I mean? We've got to lay out a new pathway in our brain. It takes some doing, because the old pathway has been trodden so many times. So, of course, it's easier just to do what you've always done. But we need to put the pause in and remind ourselves, hold on, I'd made the decision that I was going to try a different path, and I was going to focus just on moving forward down that path and see where that took me, and keep my eye on the prize, you know, at the end of that pathway, or at least along the way, because it's all about the journey, right? And so, you know, she described this conversation. It was great how she described it. It was very relatable for other people. She described that this voice literally was going through all the fabulous reasons why it would be such a good idea to reward herself with a bottle of Prosecco or whatever the hell it was, you know, that she was thinking of having. And then she was able to pause just momentarily and remind herself, hold on a minute. No, actually, it won't be rewarding at all. I will drink that. I will feel terrible. I'll feel sleepy. I'll have arguments with my partner. I'll have an absolutely miserable end to the evening. I'll wake up the next day feeling terrible. That whole of the next morning will probably be blown out. Then I'm going to have to come back on the Sober Club and admit that I've failed. I'll absolutely hate myself again. What on earth am I thinking of? And that's what we need. We need that accountability. And it starts by being connected with other people so that you know that there's going to be another little layer there, another layer of accountability for when that voice in the head comes on strong. We've all been there. The good news is it gets less and less. It really does. And now, on the very rare occasion, I even have the tiniest glimmer of a thought. It really is the tiniest passing kind of momentary sort of, oh, those people are drinking. And I sometimes think that's a pretty bottle. You see very attractive bottles of booze, just as well the bottles are attractive, right? But literally within a nanosecond, my rational brain kicks in and I just think, no, I absolutely do not want self-harm. I did that for enough years, thank you. I ain't going there again. So get connected. That's my message. And know that you can do this. Reach out. Just reach out. If you don't want to join us in the Sober Club or you don't want to join whatever community, then just reach out. Tell someone you're doing this, because that's when it gets really tough, when it's just you and that voice in your head. So reach out. You know where to find me. I'm very easy to find on social media at Janie Lee Grace, or go to thesoberclub.com. And even if you don't want to join us, there's a contact form there. You can always get in touch and I'll respond if I can. I really don't want to leave anyone feeling desperate. There's always help out there. So thank you again for listening to the podcast. It really means the world to me. Thank you so much to those of you that were able to come and those of you that were, I know, cheering us on, even though you weren't able to be there. It really means a lot. And drop me a message if you would like to come to the next one, and I'll make sure you get the first dibs on the tickets, because it sold out quickly last time. I'll see you soon. See you next week.
Thank you for listening to the Alcohol Free Life podcast, brought to you by The Sober Club. Please rate and review. And if you want support, accountability and inspiration, and you want to live your best life without the booze, check out thesoberclub.com.